Well, we come to chapter 4 of Ecclesiastes. And certainly, this is a book that throws up questions as well as answers. And so it's a great book, isn't it, to the questioning nature of people. What's the point of life? Is life worth living in the end? See, so much in the modern age is discouraging, so much is distracting. But as the phrase we see in Ecclesiastes, which repeats again and again, says, there is no new thing or nothing new under the sun. We sometimes make a big mistake, don't we, thinking that the world of today is so different from the world of the past that the past has nothing to teach us. And yet, actually, when we come to a book like this, we see that people ask the same questions. Or they muse or philosophize on the same issues. And here we have Solomon, one of the wisest men of his generation, indeed, probably one of the wisest men who ever lived, looking at life. And when we get to chapter 4, in a sense, he's retreading some of what he's already looked at. And here, he not just revisits the unfairness of life, he's touched on that in chapter 3. In chapter 3, he says in verse 16, I saw something else under the sun. In a place of judgment, wickedness was there. In a place of justice, wickedness was there. Now, Solomon may have been wise. And in many ways, he may have done some good things. Although, read the whole story, he certainly goes off the rails a bit. But he realizes that the nature of even his kingdom, there's corruption at various points. This is going to be picked up very much here. And here in chapter 4, and we need to sometimes lay ground rules as we look at the passage, he starts to speak in a way that is not untypical in wisdom literature. He's done this pretty much all the way through, but now it becomes very stark. He offers contrasts. He uses something, he uses an extreme to make a point. And he certainly starts this by doing that. He looks, verse 1, in a sense taking a reappraisal of all he's looked at so far, and he says this, life can be so unfair that sometimes you wonder whether it's worth living. Indeed, is it worth being born at all? Isn't there some advantage in not being born if, in fact, some of the unfairness, the injustice of life, you don't experience that? I remember some years ago, it's been my favourite play ever since, and it was so great to sit through. You know, I'm going to say sit through 4 hours of a play. Yes, it's that long. To sit through Hamlet at the Young Vic once. And of course, we all know the big speech in it. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outraging fortune and by opposing them, end them, or to take up arms against a sea of troubles. And there's a point, you see, when that point in Hamlet, Hamlet has been driven to distraction so much. He's actually quite a cheerful young man, but he's given to melancholy when he starts to realise how corrupt the kingdom is. He's had this visitation of the spirit of his dead father, who claims that his stepfather, the man his mother has now married, murdered him. He's looking round and he sees corruption and he starts to see the court there. As he says later in the film, there is something rotten in the state of Denmark. He starts to see corruption and it takes hold of him. And of course the big question is he mad? Is he framing madness? I think he's framing madness because actually he sees this. But even if he's framing it, there's a certain imbalance to his actions. And the point is this. In the end, is it worth it? Because this is what Hamlet says. No more. And there, by sleep, we say to end the heartache and thousand natural shocks that the flesh is heir to. So he's sort of swaying, isn't he, between life and death. Is it better? Well, look, if you die, well, you don't have to actually... I wouldn't have to put up with this stuff anymore. Solomon takes another look and enlarges on what he's seen in chapter 3. Chapter 4, verse 1, second part. I saw the tears of the oppressed. They had no comforter. The power was on the side of their oppressors. What's he saying? He's looking around. If you can get away with it, if you've got the power and clout to get away with it, why not get away with it? Who cares about the weak? I can remember in my last church, there was a young man who used to work. I used to work with Steve as a city missioner. And he was a chap who was vulnerable. He had made a profession of faith, but he worked in the youth club under the supervision of Steve and myself. And suddenly one day he came to Steve for money. And Steve was very suspicious and started to question him. What we found out in the end was this. He'd been on the bus, he just brushed past a girl as far as you could see. He was accused of sexual molesting her, which, knowing him, I think was highly unlikely. She'd made that accusation, said, I'm going to get you into a lot of trouble. And he said, oh, no, 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 I could lose my job at the youth club. And she spotted a vulnerable person, and they started to empty his bank account. And we say that's shocking, but doesn't that really... It's age old, isn't it? Here we see it. The power is on the side of their oppressor. Someone sees an advantage, someone sees someone vulnerable, let's take advantage of it. And a bit like Hamlet, Solomon starts to question, if that's the case, isn't it better to be dead? Better still, better not to be born. If that's what life is about. It's not an uncommon theme in wisdom literature, interestingly enough. We have it in Job, don't we? Job chapter 3. After Job's two tests, there he is, poor guy, sitting, suffering, lost his family, suffering ill health, with his three friends with him, who incidentally have... There's a great lesson in counselling here. Job's friends get it dead right. They sit with him, don't they? They just sit with him. It's all going to go pear-shaped when they start opening their mouths. But the first thing Job says when he opens his mouth, Job 3, chapter verse 1, after this Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth and said, may the day of my birth perish and the night it was said a boy is born. Later on in the same discourse, he says this. Or why was I not hidden in the ground like a stillborn child, like an infant who never saw the light of day? You see, that was the point. Sometimes when we're in the middle of something, and Job's a good example of this, remember there's a section of his life where he suffers horribly. But actually, he's incredibly blessed both sides of it. Sometimes when we're in the middle of something, and I think Solomon's using this as an extreme example, we literally do say, what is the point? What is the point? And this can affect us in many ways, can't it? It affects us in life. It affects us in faith. And the great encouragement is we have this great book. And isn't it just great? The The Bible is a divinely inspired book, but it's a book written by human beings, inspired by the Holy Spirit. And the point is this, they get knocked about, buffeted by the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, as Hamlet says. They do, don't they? The psalmist will look at the world, pick a psalm, there's plenty to choose from, and will say, why do the wicked prosper? Why do people who give no time to you seem to get away with everything? They do that, don't they? Constantly. Yes, often they come and get the broader view at the end of God being in control and everything like that. But the point is this, they look at it and they just, it's impossible. There is no justice. And when people sort of say they have problems with Ecclesiastes, there's a sense in perhaps it's a little bit more stark, it's a little bit extreme, but literature tends to be like that. But it's only saying things that you will find other places in the Bible. There's a lack of justice. That's the first thing, isn't it, that he makes. The first point he makes is going to make three. Secondly, once we get into that frame of mind, there's a danger of perverted reasoning. He now takes a look at labour again. He's been there before, hasn't he? And actually, interestingly enough, twice we've come to the conclusion, guided by Solomon, that labours can be a good thing. Work, life can be a good thing. Chapter 2, verse 24. A man can do nothing better than to eat or drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God. Again. He said this twice. Verse 12 of chapter 3. I know there is nothing better for men to be happy and do good where they live, and everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is a gift of God. The Puritans, if people actually know who they are today, and there's a dearth of, you know, terrible ignorance in church history, the Puritans are sometimes seen as these people who went around with gloomy faces and stuff like that. No, these were people who knew that God was a good God. He gave enjoyment to those who served him. They knew that there were many good gifts from him. Work, food and drink, marriage, family. I won't go in, maybe I'll save it for when I preach the Song of Songs next year, if the Lord hasn't come by then. But there were some pretty, what we would consider, bawdy songs sung at Puritan weddings, because they had no sort of reservations about what the bride and groom were going to get up to later when they were married. They saw this as good stuff. But Solomon points out that work can be a trap. Verse 4. Here's a guy working his socks off. Why is he doing it? Not for the reason Solomon has given. He's doing it because he looks at his neighbour and is envious. He is, to use the old phrase, trying to keep ahead of the Joneses. And Solomon looks at that from the point of view that God has given work, which can be enjoyed. He's given the results of work that can be enjoyed. And he says this is perverted. This is a nothing. We get that phrase, very important in Ecclesiastes. We understand this. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The Hebrew word, hebel. Best probably, we don't get the full translation. Mist, vapour. It may look solid. I've given a couple of examples in other sermons on how mist can look at like a wall, can't it? But you just go into it, it's a nothing. You can't grab it, you can't do it. It will be vapour, it will disappear as quickly as it comes. So you see, work can be good, but from the wrong motives, it's a nothing. Okay, Solomon says, as wisdom teachers often do, a bit like Proverbs here, where it takes extremes or parallels. If that's not the way, what about doing nothing, a life of leisure? The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Actually, it's interesting. King James Version or ESV, which is probably a bit more literal, eats his flesh, consumes himself. So what's the right answer? Well, the answer is given here. We're given advice. Verse 6, better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Know what they're saying there. Toil, if you make that your centre, you will be like one who chases mist or vapour. It will not satisfy. There always will be something that's lacking. Better to be moderate and content in your work. In fact, it's a pretty good maxim for life, isn't it? To get obsessed with the things of this world, or certain things in this world, do lead to emptiness and tragedy. Do you know, I've never yet heard of someone who has as their epitaph and has a tombstone engraved with, I wish I spent more time at the office and not with my family. Please tell me if you ever come across a tombstone with that on. I'd be very interested. I'd love to know about the life of that person. You look at the discomfort of people. A famous millionaire was once asked about when, you know, what's enough money? And this guy had millions. And he said, and this is telling, $1 more than you've got. It's a chasing, isn't it? Can you see, the guy's literally, gosh, you should be a commentator on this verse. He's literally explaining this idea of Hebel. It's always going to be out of grasp. It's always going to be like mist. It's always going to disappear. It's always going to be like you can't grab hold of it. It won't satisfy. The film's just come out about John Paul Getty, all the money in the world, and by golly, he was rich. And yet his life was a series of tragedy in so many ways. You see, what Solomon's saying is don't let work rule you. Don't fall for the treadmill of life. If you want to look at it again, if you're taking notes, it's worth just reading chapter 1, 3 to 8 again, because that wonderful series of the treadmill of life. The sun rises, the sun sets, but hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north and goes round again, ever returning to its course more. And it's just wonderful stuff. But basically it says life is a treadmill, and you, if you're not careful, will be finding yourself walking to nowhere on it. That's the issue, isn't it? Don't be ruled by that. What's a good perspective? Well, a good perspective here is fellowship. You see, if this is all meaningless, then what are we to sort of grasp as something that could be of worth? Well, it's fellowship. The example is given in verse 8 of this man who is all alone. He works and works and works, but he doesn't seem to be doing it for much purpose. No one actually benefits from it. He doesn't seem to be benefiting from it. He just seems too busy all the time. In fact, he asks that question, why am I toiling? Why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless and miserable business. My dad actually used to work very hard. He got a very he was a science teacher. Eventually, he went into the Inspectorate of Education, and he eventually ended up as a chief inspector in a London borough. He was a man I admired very much. He once said to me, "The irony of life is that when you're young and you need money, you don't have it. When you're old like me, they give you too much of it." I always remember that my mother said that that attitude was useful, because the good thing was, because Dad had that attitude, he used that money for good stuff. He used it to support Christian mission. He used it to support the church. He used it so other people could hear of the good news of the gospel. Yes, it may have been an irony, but that didn't mean that good couldn't come out of it. And this is what Solomon says in the end. Fellowship's the key thing. Some people say that these verses are about marriage. I think it's pretty much because of verse 11, two lie down together, they will keep warm. But in a sense, it's mainly about fellowship. This idea of two people working to the same task. For a lot of the time, I worked on my own when I was a builder and decorator. Every now and again, I call in my mate, Neil. Now, the good thing about Neil was he was a skilled builder, he was a skilled decorator, and the fact was this. He was getting on one job, while I was getting on with another. Both need to be done in the completion of the complete task. Or we'd work together and get things done twice or three times faster. Yes, there's a better return for work when you work together. There's a better return in a church if you have fellowship together. If you're working to the same cause, isn't it? Lone Ranger Christians can only do so much. A pastor can only do so much. He can only meet so many people. He can only do so much. He can only visit so many people. With all the other things that there are to be done. But the key thing is fellowship does and can multiply the results of what we do as a church. There's another thing here, isn't there? And this is underrated, I think, in this day and age. It's a mutual dependency. If one falls down, a friend can help him up. One of the sad things you occasionally get is you get this situation, I've been in it, where people are suddenly struggling and you find out. And the phrase I remember, "Oh, they've been struggling for ages." It always used to grieve me as a pastor if no one told me. Or they hadn't told me. We're there actually to support each other. And it's not just about what the pastor does. It's about what we all do. We actually, I believe, and I think this is important, when we come together, be we big or small in our congregation, we encourage each other. The world is a tough place. We're buffeted about. You go and stand on Stony High Street, put a poster board out. Do things, talk to people about Christian things. You'll very quickly find how popular you are, or not. Very interesting. I remember one time when we, as we do, advertised one of our services on social media and got the most tremendous flack both ways. And most of it was extremely negative. All of which I challenge people, come to the service, have a chat with me afterwards. Social media, it's easier, isn't it, to engage. But you'll find out how popular it is. But here we look around and we see others who believe what we believe. Others who are facing the same trials. And actually we need to share with each other, don't we, and have that support. Fellowship is important, isn't it? Two lie down together, they will keep warm. There's almost a sense here, it's very well actually, the Hebrew suggests it could apply to marriage, but it does apply as much to sort of travelling, keeping warm on the road. They apparently, there's one of the forts in America, they used to have bunks in there where 12 men would get in the bed together because it just kept warmer together. There's some sense in that. Cord of three strands, a woven together cord, cannot so be quickly broken. What's it saying here? Well, it's saying, isn't it, two's good, three's better. In fact, fellowship is stronger. So we've looked at a lack of justice to sort of really sort of shake us up and challenge us. We looked at the danger of perverted reasoning and the good reasoning, you know, the cure to that is good reasoning. And lastly, we're going to see that wisdom is better, but Solomon being Solomon says, well, hold on a second, it has its limits. Earthly wisdom will get you so far. We get a little parable here, don't we, at the end of the passage. This picture of an old king. He's been on his throne a long time. Perhaps he's been flattered a bit. Perhaps he started out well, it seems to suggest it. But he's grown too comfortable. He doesn't heed the dissenting voice. Better to be a poor, wise youth than that king. There's a few problems in the translation here, which is often the case with Hebrew. Hebrew often has several words or expresses things in ways so much differently to how we do. And it's quite difficult to say whether it's referring to a poor youth who becomes a king and basically then just won't listen to advice, that's how he ends up, or a foolish old king who's displaced by this youth. I don't think it matters too much because I think actually it works out the same way. Whether it's a youth who comes to power, sort of, you know, overthrows or supplants the king, or whether he comes to power from poverty but then succumbs to foolishness. The point is this. Wisdom will get you a certain way. It may even make you popular for a time, but it has its limits. There's a fickleness to popularity, isn't there? We see this in today's day and age. A few years ago, the Spice Girls ruled the world. Someone said they're going to reform again. I can take that or leave it, to be honest. But the point is this. When they came to do their third album, the sales plummeted. What happened? All their fans had found, most of their fans had found something new to move on to. A new group, a new girl group, new boy group, I don't know. They found something, they found a distraction, and it's fickle, isn't it? Oliver Cromwell had his feet on the ground. Once, when he became Lord Protector of England, he was with a friend and there were cheering crowds. As they went through the crowds, the friend sort of was saying, look how popular you are. Oliver Cromwell said this. Do not trust their cheering, for those persons would shout as much if you or I were going to be hanged. He knew how fickle people are. So what's the issue here? Well, the issue is to remember what Solomon has been telling us all the way through. This is under the sun. But the key verse, and we must remember the book in relation to this verse, is this. Verse 13 of chapter 1. I devoted myself to study and explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. Where's that coming from? Why does he say that? Why is that so true to biblical theology? Well, I'll tell you why. Because this is Genesis 3, 17, 19. This is the curse of man's fall. We don't have to look it up again. What's the gist of what Adam's told? By the sweat of your brow, you will labour. Yes, it was a wonderful place to be, the Garden of Eden. They tended it. They had God's care. But when they sinned, the result of the curse was God saying, right, it's going to be a heavy burden. So you see what Solomon's saying here? He's saying be careful of what is good or can be good. Yes, there's injustice. He very clearly says that at the start of the chapter. But he says there's some good stuff here, but it can be corrupted by our Genesis 3 thinking. That's the issue in the end. Good things have limitations. They also become traps. Because we are fallen beings. We take work that could be pleasurable, could be enjoyable, and we make it our God. We make it our idol. Enjoy, he says, but don't serve it. As he says when it comes to work. He said this, didn't he? He said the key thing was better to have one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil. Don't get carried away. Well, as we say, Christ is found in the scriptures, isn't he? How's he found in this? Well, he's found in an impression. He's found in this one, I think it's this, that he has the remedy for the thinking that gets trapped by the world. Chapter 16 of John's Gospel, 33. I have told you these things that you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. When he's saying that, what is he saying? He's saying, I am going, I have overcome, it's a certainty, I'm overcoming the curse of work, the curse of separation from God. Everything that has been broken is going to eventually be fixed. And there's a huge sense in which we can enjoy that now. Indeed, John then enlarges on this brilliantly, I think, in John 1 John 4 and 5. For everyone who born of God overcomes the world. This is the victory that has overcome the world. Even our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world? Only he who believes in Jesus, the Son of God. Yes, the Puritans got it right. Life can be enjoyed. Yes, it can be hard. Yes, it can be unfair. But they got it right. Westminster Confession. What is the chief duty of man? To enjoy God and to serve him forever. What does Jesus offer? He says, I've overcome the world. And if he's overcome the world, what is he saying? Well, he's literally saying this. John 10, verse 10. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that you may have life and have it to its full. I can remember some years ago interviewing my pastor Wallace Benn. He'd just actually become Bishop of Lewis at that time. I did a long interview with him, which was videoed for a mission we were doing. And we were talking about a wide range of things. Human goodness, could we be good before God by our own merits? Obviously the answer was no. And he expressed that very, very eloquently. And then we came to the end. And we were talking about the benefit, and he emphasized this, that actually it's not about dreaming of a future if you're a Christian. It's about experiencing God's goodness. And he said this at the end, it's not pie in the sky when you die, it's steak on the plate while you wait. I hope I don't offend any vegetarians. I myself am a vegetarian, so I'm quite happy saying that. In other words, there's good stuff now. And God offers that. And he offers it to you. And if you've become a slave to the things the world offers, if you're placing too much on what you have, it will only last for a time anyway. And ultimately, these things become old. I remember in my last church, the son of one of my deacons showed me his iPod, and he said, it can store, I can't remember, something ridiculous number of tunes. He said, actually, you couldn't listen to all that in a lifetime. And yet, an iPod came out with a greater memory and people go and buy it. Why? They can't store anymore. They can't listen to any more music. Because we have this natural craving for something new. We have this natural craving for experience. And Jesus says, don't do that. I've overcome that. I can free you from that. I can free you from the dissatisfaction of that. I can free you from the disobedience of that. And I can give you new life. Don't be a slave to the world, because that will only trap you and condemn you. That is sinful. That is a rejection of the Maker who has made these good things. Yes, there's good things in technology. Yes, technology can be used for bad things. I'm sure Solomon, if he looked at the world today, would say the same. But the key thing is this. Christ has overcome. We can have new life in him. We can have assurance of a future with him. We can confess our sins. Confess that we serve the world rather than him. And receive new life, forgiveness, and peace of mind. And a peace of mind that whatever the world throws at us, and it will, Solomon is the realist, the Bible is realistic, God has overcome the world. Whatever you face, whatever you see tomorrow, however people may talk of you or whatever they view of you, you can know an assurance. Let's pray.